From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. This afternoon, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said the words of former Defense Secretary James Mattis were true, honest, necessary, and overdue.
Mattis shocked Washington yesterday with a scathing criticism of President Trump. He said he was angry and appalled at how the government is handling the nationwide demonstrations against racial injustice and police brutality. He called the decision to clear peaceful protesters from outside the White House this week an abuse of executive authority. Let's bring in Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh. He's a senior research associate at MIT's Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And to remind people, Mattis is a Marine general who resigned as Secretary of Defense in December. He made comments in a statement to The Atlantic saying Trump is, quote, the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. How significant are these statements coming from a very respected former military leader?
Yes, I've met with Mattis. I met with him when he was head of CENTCOM. Later, he became Secretary of Defense. I think they're significant, one, because in the main, military officials try to refrain from criticizing the president. Certainly, as people who are not retired try to avoid that, and even the retired military officers strive to do that. And in this case, we have Mattis making a statement. We have others who have made statements. And more tellingly, we've had statements from people in the military, acting commanders, who have issued official statements basically expressing concern about the protests and about police brutality and those sorts of things. That's very unusual for them to be making statements on what are domestic issues. And I interpret both Mattis's statements, Mullen's statements, other people's statements, and these statements from active military as signaling, saying, hey, we're concerned about this. This might be moving in the wrong direction, and it makes them feel uncomfortable.
Well, that's the Mullen. So you're talking about former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, who made some statements against what the president is doing. We also have heard from retired General John Allen, the former commander of American forces in Afghanistan, who wrote a scathing op-ed against President Trump in foreign policy. And then in terms of the current military leaders, are you referring to Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who said, we must reject any thinking of our cities as a battle space that our uniformed military is called upon to dominate. That angered President Trump, and then Esper had to reverse the decision to send home the troops from D.C.
Yeah, so I was not talking about Esper. I'm talking about people who are actually military officers. Esper is a civilian serving in a civilian role as Secretary of Defense. I'm talking about active members of the military in the officer corps who have issued statements about the unrest and about police brutality. You asked me before, did these things, you know, were these significant statements, did they make a difference? The fact that Esper changed his tune is evidence to me that they did make a difference, that he felt compelled under criticism to change his view. And then he changed it back after reportedly President Trump blew up at him and yelled at him. He changed again. So we have a real lack of leadership in the Department of Defense at the head there, a person who keeps shifting back and forth. But it's clear that the military itself feels very uncomfortable. Mattis is probably channeling some inside the Pentagon, and then obviously others in the Pentagon itself are also expressing concern.
Well, a lot of the concern is just about the idea of using the U.S. military against American citizens in America. We've heard now that among the troops deployed in Washington, D.C. have been armed forces with no identifying insignia who refuse to identify themselves to protesters and reporters. This week, the Attorney General, William Barr, directed the Federal Bureau of Prisons to deploy riot teams in D.C. What do you make of that?
Well, that seems like a workaround. So there's sensitivity about using members of the military for domestic policing. That should never happen. The members of the military are trained to fight wars and to kill enemies abroad. They're not trained in policing domestic protests. So there's a real line there. Let me also say that it's important to remember that some 40% of the military is made up of African Americans who may have views about this particular topic and may feel uncomfortable being put in a domestic policing role. As for the Bureau of Prisons, that might be a way for Barr to sort of try to marshal some people and please the president. But I wonder about the wisdom of that. We are currently in a federal prison lockdown. that had started over COVID and now has been extended. And so to deploy resources from the from the Bureau of Prisons at a time when the prisons are in lockdown may be unwise.
That is Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn to another big story, the pandemic. More than a dozen states are seeing a daily increase of COVID-19 cases. Mississippi, Arkansas, and Arizona have hit records in new daily cases in just the last week, with numbers also rising in Tennessee. Dr. Jeannie Marazzo is director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and she's also part of the state's coronavirus task force. And doctor, what's happening right now with the coronavirus, specifically in the South?
So the South has been somewhat delayed in its experience of coronavirus. And I think that one thing people need to understand is that as the virus spreads, there are successive dynamic waves of transmission, and that's why we're seeing so much variability. So you saw the introduction largely on the West Coast and the Northwest, but very soon after in New York City and the Northeast, and then a gradual movement down to the Southeast, which is really where the burden of the U.S. experience is occurring right now. Even in the Southeast, we're seeing variations in pockets of intensity. So if you look at a state level, in a state like Alabama, for example, you can see that some of the counties that had the earliest outbreaks of infection are now experiencing a somewhat waning of that intensity, and other counties that are vulnerable are now coming on board and seeing a lot more infections.
You're saying that there's been a delay in spread in the South, and yet this also coincides with many of these states partially reopening. Can you talk about that dynamic for a moment?
Yes, if I could figure out that dynamic, I'd probably win some sort of major prize, because there are so many dynamic variables impacting what we are seeing as a somewhat superficial epidemiology of this virus. You not only have huge shifts in population mixing and mobility, right, as these physical distancing measures are modified. So that's a huge variable. On the second level, you've got just the virus doing its thing and, you know, continuing to transmit at its usual pace. And at the third level, you have the dynamic of who's getting tested. So very, very difficult to be really confident in any big picture profiling of where this virus is going. And that's one of the reasons we don't know what's going to happen in the next couple of months or the fall.
Speaking of that, you know, especially in April, we were having lots of discussions about the impact on medical systems. I'm wondering, are you thinking that these increases are big enough to overload local medical systems? And what point do you think they should trigger a stop to the reopenings that we're seeing in some southern states?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And I can give you some specific examples. You know, for example, here we have a 1,500 or so bed hospital, fairly large ICU, and with very good adherence to physical distancing in March through April, we were able to keep things pretty much under control. Unfortunately, what we're seeing now, despite that effort, is that we're having to take transfers from smaller cities like Montgomery, for example, that are experiencing a surge. The other dynamic with that, and this is true throughout the South, is that in the last decade plus, we have seen closures of many small rural hospitals. You have the situation of a very vulnerable population, lots of comorbidities, often remote, who don't have the local healthcare safety net that they need. They are then being brought to regional cities that have regional medical centers, which are then getting very much overloaded. So it's really going to be a question of monitoring the capacity of the referring and the referral hospitals very closely. And we're doing that on a day-by-day basis.
Dr. Anthony Fauci of the White House Coronavirus Task Force told the Journal of the American Medical Association this week that a coronavirus vaccine may not give long-term immunity. He said immunity from common coronavirus actually lasts about 3 to 6 months, almost always less than a year. Is too much hope being put on a vaccine?
I would agree with Dr. Fauci in that I think vaccine research is fraught with uncertainties, hope, and failure, and some success, right? So I think we've never really understood or intervened with coronavirus to create sustained immunity because, frankly, creating a vaccine for the common cold has not been a particularly high priority in the scientific research agenda. The good news about the coronavirus research program that's moving forward is that there are several what are called platforms for developing these vaccines. They're using different targets. So if things really get off the ground in the next 6 months, we should get some answers within the next year. And that's really what we need. It's really hard to say without the hard data.
That's Dr. Jeannie Marazzo. She's director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thanks. My pleasure.
It feels like nothing in the news these days makes any sense. So Hassan Minhaj turned to his father and his faith for answers.
He said, don't worry about the number of questions. Just worry about which questions become more clear and solidified.
Comedian Hassan Minhaj on how his spirituality is getting him through. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
A memorial service will be held for George Floyd in Minneapolis today, 10 days after he died in police custody. The former officer at the center of the incident, Derek Chauvin, has been charged with second-degree murder. Three other former officers also face charges for involvement in the death. Meanwhile, protests continue around the country. Stephanie Stokes from member station WABE in Atlanta takes us there.
The center of the protest is in downtown Atlanta, around Centennial Olympic Park. Crowds of a couple thousand gather each day in the nearby streets. The new charges against the Minneapolis officers didn't change that, although Olivia Young says she was happy to hear the news.
That's a big step. It's a really big step. I hope we get a conviction now. So
she wants people to know why protesters are out here.
It's a bigger picture and it's a meaning that everybody needs to see that Black Lives Matter and that justice should always be for everybody.
The demonstrators show up despite a sometimes heavy response from police. The city put a curfew into effect after the first night of protests ended with vandalism and looting. Officers often use tear gas to disperse crowds or move them away from government buildings. Trey Clopton has a large purple bruise on his leg. He says it's from rubber bullets. He plans to keep demonstrating.
I'll be out here every day, until something changes.
Most protesters, like him, have remained peaceful. Clopton has even engaged officers in discussions about reform. When Clopton talks about why he's out here, he points to his brother. He's a jogger like Ahmaud Arbery, a Black man who was recently shot in southwest Georgia. Clopton worries every time his brother goes out for a run.
I don't want to feel that anymore.
Many of the people out here have a personal story like that. Signs that stick up above the crowds reference other family members, nephews. Kendrell David got off work so he could finally join the protests. His sign mentions his son.
I love him so much. I don't want him growing up in a world like this right now.
There already have been some shifts in Atlanta. The city fired two officers for excessive force. They were involved in tasing two college students during the protests. And last night, for the first time, law enforcement didn't use tear gas to clear the area around the park. The night still ended in arrest, though. Atlanta police report around 400 arrests since protests began last Friday. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Stokes in Atlanta.
The city of San Francisco lifts its curfew today after days of protest. Last night, there was a peaceful march of an estimated 10,000 plus people in the city with only a handful of arrests. We're joined now by San Francisco Mayor London Breed. Mayor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, and let's start with the protests that we're seeing in your city. You've said that you are the mayor of the city, but a Black woman first. How long do you think that these protests will continue?
Well, I will say that people are mad and people are hurt and people are sick and tired. So I think that they're not just going to disappear. I think people want to be heard. They want this to stop. And so I think that the reason why there's been a lot of attention brought to it, sadly, because of the violence and the looting and the vandalism and those sorts of things. And I've made it clear to people, look, we are not implementing a curfew in San Francisco to just protect property. We're doing it to protect people. We're trying to protect the protesters. We want them to go home safely. We want the police to go home safely. We want everyone to go home safely. And so part of what we are trying to do is protect the public as best we can, but we want to make sure people have an opportunity to protest.
What do you think of the response that you've seen from the White House? President Trump has been saying that governors need to get tougher on the protesters who get out of hand. He's talked about using dogs, using the U.S. military, sending people to jail for years. What do you think about that?
I think we're in a really sad place when we have the person who's responsible for everyone in this country pushing for division. We have to acknowledge the hurt and the pain. As hard as it is, property can be repaired and replaced. People can't. And we are tired of African-American men dying at the hands of law enforcement. And we want to see change. And I think that that has to be acknowledged before this aggressive military response is even talked about. It shouldn't even have a place in the discussion right now. And what I hope it does for the folks who are protesting and upset and angry, I hope what this does is it pushes them to the polls.
I want to ask you about what's happening there in San Francisco at the police department, because as you know, there's a video that appeared maybe a week ago that shows a San Francisco police officer back in January briefly kneeling on a black teenager's neck, similar to what happened with George Floyd in Minneapolis. Now, the incident in San Francisco was not fatal, but what did you think when you saw that video and heard about that?
Well, after everything we've done here in San Francisco around police reform, all I can think about is this is not acceptable and we have to do better. We have implemented various trainings, but there is no training for common sense and also common decency. I get that the police officers were trying to restrain this individual for whatever reason, but that move is not something that should have occurred. And we have to do better. And I am committed as the mayor of the city who is responsible for this police department to making sure that these kinds of incidents don't continue to happen and that we hold officers in this city accountable. And also other officers have to hold one another accountable. I've gotten so many calls from police officers in San Francisco to say, we are so angry about what happened to George Floyd. I mean, they were angry. I said, well, don't tell me. Tell your fellow officers. Tell the public. You all have to be a part of the solution as well, because this is not okay, and we have to change it.
Well, do you support an overhaul, as the San Francisco Public Defender's Office has called for, an overhaul of use of force policies at the police department?
I definitely want to be clear that we have been working towards overhauling those policies. And I think the problem is the people who are calling for things should probably read what the policies are first to understand all the reforms that we have made that we are trying to implement. And people are like, well, why haven't you implemented the reforms faster? And let me tell you why. Because we want these officers to get it. We're not just making everybody go through training to go through training. They need to understand what it means as it relates to anti-bias training. They need to understand the time and distance policy so when they're out on the field, they can put this into action. They have to believe in it. They have to do it. And if we have people who have a problem with policing Black communities, if they have a problem with Asians or anything else, they should not be working in this department because of their inherent nature of being sadly racist. So it's bigger than just the policy.
Mayor Breed, as you know, this is happening in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. Now, you have kept San Francisco very tightly locked down, and you've had much better results than most other cities in this country as a result of that. But outdoor dining is going to restart in the middle of June in San Francisco. Do you think other cities are moving too quickly? Should more people be following your lead, or do you think San Francisco is just different than other places?
Because I'm not managing those cities and I don't know what challenges they have, it's hard for me to suggest that other cities should be doing what San Francisco is doing. I do think that at this point, we need to move a lot faster because we are seeing the curve drop and the economy is suffering and people who are low-income residents of the city have lost their job. And so I think what's important is we get this city open as quickly as we possibly can because this virus is with us. So now it's time for us to adjust our new normal and make sure we do everything we can to keep people safe.
Are you at the point now where anybody who wants a test can get one in San Francisco?
Yes. If you are a San Francisco resident and you exhibit one symptom, you can get tested. If you also are an essential worker, any essential worker in San Francisco, whether you're a resident or not, you don't have to exhibit any symptoms. You can get tested anytime.
And do you think that come the fall, people in San Francisco are going to be tested all the time? Or do you think we will have passed that point and gotten back to something that feels more like normal by that point?
You know, it's going to be tough because it's really going to depend on the number of cases, the number of deaths, the number of hospitalizations. The goal is to make sure that our testing capacity, our PPE, our contact tracing, and all of these measures are in place. And we are in a good place even today. So I think in the fall, we'll be in an even better place.
I have one more question for you, Mayor Breed. As you know, Twitter has said its workers are going to be able to work from home forever. That is a company that is based in your city of San Francisco. Do you expect other companies will do the same thing? And are you worried about what that would mean for your tax revenue there?
Well, two things. I'm definitely worried. Other companies have already done it and will continue to do it. And it will have an impact on our economy. But ultimately, people are going to want to come into San Francisco. They're not going to always want to work at home. The option is great to have, but being around other people and enjoying city life, people are going to get restless and they're going to want to come back to work. It's going to be tough for us for some time. And my hope is that we can get back to normal sooner rather than later.
That is London Breed, the mayor of the city of San Francisco. Mayor Breed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Today marks 1 week since protests began in New York City, and so far police have arrested more than 1,000 people. The protests, largely peaceful, have also been marked by episodes of police violence against protesters. For more, we have Gwen Hogan. She's a reporter at WNYC. She's been covering the protests for a week now. And Gwen, let's start with last night. There were reports and videos of police attacking protesters in Brooklyn. What more can you tell us about that?
Yes, so I was not out last night because I needed a rest, but my colleagues were out there. And in downtown Brooklyn, there was a massive crowd of peaceful protesters, completely peaceful. There was no looting, there was no vandalism, and seemingly at random, police began using their batons on many people and making violent arrests.
Mm. As you mentioned, you have been on the streets most nights since this protest began. Tell us a little of what you've seen and how these encounters between police and protesters have escalated.
Yeah, it's been totally different every night, very unpredictable. So the first night that I covered was last Thursday. That was the first march. It was a relatively small group to compared to what we've seen since. But there were 70 arrests, which I've covered tons of protests. I've been a reporter here for 7 years, and I had never seen a protest with that many arrests. The next night at the Barclays Center, crowds were trying to gather at Barclays early in the evening. There was no curfew, but they were met by massive amounts of police and riot gear who started macing and batoning people. And from there, it kind of just set off, you know, there were police vans burned that night and similar things have happened since then. And there was, of course, the looting that began on Sunday night into Monday. But since then, marches have been largely peaceful. Yesterday, it was peaceful all day. And yet we still saw this remarkable show of force by NYPD officers confronting peaceful protesters just for being out after curfew.
And you and your colleagues have been talking with these protesters over the last few days about what they're seeing and experiencing. Tell us more.
There's obviously a lot of anger and frustration. The vast majority of people that are there want peaceful demonstrations. So we've seen when there are big crowds, the crowd kind of policing itself and making sure that nobody breaks anything. And I saw this on Sunday night, right before the real looting in Soho began. I watched dozens of protesters put their bodies in front of a smashed window saying, no, this is not the fight. We cannot let looting be the headline here. And a colleague of mine was in Midtown Manhattan the other night, and he was with a group who were dancing in front of a police line. They had been told by sergeants they could march if they remained peaceful. And yet a few minutes later, they were being rushed with batons and people were making arrests. So this is Tyrell Reed right after that happened.
And now they're coming trying to scare us, running us down with batons, thinking that they're gonna scare us away. No, I'm out here to fight for my cause, and I'm ready to die. They're beating on women, helpless women. She's screaming for her life. She's scared. How many people can't breathe before we have to get the message to you? That is not right. You do not beat on us like that. We're peacefully protesting.
It's just the irony that we've seen. They're out there. Their number one demand is end police brutality. And yet, despite the peaceful nature of the vast majority of these protests, they're met by more police brutality.
That's WNYC reporter Gwen Hogan. She's been covering the protests in New York City and will continue to do so. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Back in 1973, it seemed that Bruce Lee became a star overnight with the premiere of the martial arts film Enter the Dragon. Audiences were transfixed by his fighting style, punctuated by Lee's outcries. Unfortunately, stardom came too late for Bruce Lee, who died before the film's opening. He was 32 years old. But as we see in the new documentary, Be Water, in his short career, Bruce Lee broke the long-held stereotypes of Asian men, even when those stereotypes threatened to hold him back. Be Water premieres on ESPN this Sunday, and director Bao Nguyen joins us now via Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanya.
And Bao, I'm a late 80s kid, and Bruce Lee was such an important pop culture icon. Every kid I knew was on the playground pretending to be Lee. So much of it is so remarkable that by then he had been gone almost two decades. Why was it important for you to tell Bruce Lee's story?
For me, Bruce Lee has always been this mythical figure. I've always seen him through the lens of his legacy rather than him as a person. And I realized that I didn't know anything about Bruce Lee, the person. I only, again, knew him as this icon. And I found that in order for us to really aspire and connect to these heroic figures that we relate to, we have to know who they were as a person. We have to kind of dive deep into the humanistic qualities of them. And that was one of the main goals I had when I was making the film and developing it in the first place.
One of the things we learn from your film is about Bruce Lee's childhood in Hong Kong in the 1940s and 50s. And we learned that he was actually a child film star. Tell us more about that.
Many people would consider him like the Macaulay Culkin of Hong Kong at that time. And it was interesting just unpacking the myth, right? Learning about all aspects of his life starting from Hong Kong. I felt like we really had to understand where Bruce Lee was coming from as a person who grew up in a very multicultural city like Hong Kong, but then arrived to the shores of America, first in San Francisco and then to Seattle, where he settled for a bit. And those relationships that he formed, I think, were formative to who he became as not just a martial artist, but as a philosopher and a film star.
Let's talk about that for a moment. You mentioned Seattle. His father sent him to the United States to go to school in Seattle in 1959. And as we hear from cultural critic Jeff Chang in your film, this move was a shock for him. Let's listen.
When Bruce moves to the U.S., his identity is suddenly a minority, a Chinese minority in a white country. He has to face the conundrum that all immigrants face. Who am I going to be? What is my identity? How do I express myself? And how in U.S. society? Can I even be seen?
As you point out, being seen for Bruce Lee was complicated by the way that Asian men were portrayed in film and television at the time. Can you talk more about that?
No, this was the late 1950s, early 60s. So the Vietnam War was just starting to boil up a bit. And, you know, a decade earlier was the Korean War, and two decades earlier was World War II, where the Japanese were America's enemy. So the face of the Asian American or Asian male was very much the face of the enemy to a lot of Americans. And so those type of foreign policy decisions and conflicts created the stereotypes and portrayals of Asians on screen as villains, as enemies. And also with the advent of the model minority myth, where Asians were seen as very docile and kind of subservient, they played sidekicks and they played servants. And that was the type of roles that Bruce Lee broke out of when he eventually went to Hollywood. And that was his goal, was to kind of not show the Asian American male in these stereotypical roles.
Mm. When he went to Hollywood, though, he taught martial arts. Can you talk a little bit, though, about his time in Hollywood and how those stereotypes held him back during that time?
People couldn't see past his Chinese features and his accent, even though he had a pretty great accent for someone who just came to America, right? Mm. And now his accent is quite famous and everyone tries to replicate it in many ways. But one of the things that I learned from Bruce Lee making this film is how much he was a student of everyone that he taught and everyone that he interacted with. You know, his first student, Jesse Glover, was a young African-American man. Mm-hmm. And Jesse was a victim of police brutality. And that's why he decided to learn self-defense, to learn martial arts. And I think that idea really informed Bruce. He created these ideas of bridging the gap, of building bridges between people instead of building walls and barriers. And that's another thing that I really take away that really is relevant and hopefully resonates with today's audiences.
Yeah. Bruce Lee's frustration sent him back to Hong Kong, and he became successful in films there, which led to Hollywood then becoming interested in him again, and to the making of Enter the Dragon. How much was that film an expression of Bruce Lee and the work that he wanted to do?
I think it was really a combination of all the things that he wanted to do at the time. Of course, I don't think, you know, he didn't expect that that would be his last film. But in many ways, because he was able to put in his own philosophy, his own ideas, and direct the action and really have a hand in the script. It's such a tragedy that he had this goal to break into Hollywood, to become a big star, to be this advocate for Asian American representation. And he passed away a few weeks before the opening of the film. So he never realized that dream. And I think sometimes people forget that Bruce Lee had to struggle and had to fight for where he eventually got.
Mm. I want to ask you a question about the way you filmed the documentary. You had remarkable photos and film of Lee, and you spoke to various people who knew him, but we never see the people who are talking. Why did you decide to shoot the film this way?
I wanted to feel like Bruce was in the present moment with us. The stories were very much in the present. By never going back to the modern day interviews that we shot, we're very much living in the same time period as Bruce Lee, you know, 1960s America, 1970s Hong Kong, and placing ourselves in that world. And one thing that I found very poignant, too, is at the end of the film, we start seeing some of the faces that I interviewed. Everyone is, you know, in their 70s and 80s, and we always see Bruce Lee in his 20s and 30s, and we see him in his most kind of peak, right? And I always think when I see those faces in their 80s, what would Bruce Lee have looked like in his 80s as well?
I also want to ask you, your film is called Be Water, and that's part of one of the most well-known quotes from Bruce Lee. Let's listen.
I said, empty your mind, be formless, shapeless, like water. Now you put water into a cup, it becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now water can flow, or it can crash. be water, my friend.
Can you talk more about the significance of that quote, which is now the title of your film?
I found that in addition to Bruce being water, it was a metaphor for the story of America being water and how Bruce approached America and how he saw it. And there's moments in the film where we step back a bit from Bruce's story, and then we talk about what Asians and Asian Americans had to go through that led up to the moment that Bruce Lee would be rejected by Hollywood. And I always think of these moments as sort of rocks that Bruce Lee faced and that he had to kind of get past, like water in a way, right?
Yeah.
And you know, my parents were Vietnamese war refugees, and my mother, she feels more American than Vietnamese now. So I think the idea of America is fluid, right? It blends and melds into water, just like Bruce Lee's quote says. And we're always trying to find these moments of progress. Right now, we are in a moment where we as a country are crashing against these rocks, and we have to try to find a way to move around it. But these rocks will always exist in many different forms. And I think Bruce Lee's lessons to the world are still very relevant today.
Bao Nguyen tells the story of the late actor and martial artist Bruce Lee in the new film Be Water. It airs Sunday on ESPN. Bao Nguyen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
One of the things we've seen protesters do over the last week is take a knee. It's a reference both to the police officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes and to former San Francisco 49er quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who lost his job after taking a knee in protest of police brutality and racial injustice. In 2018, President Trump said this of players adopting Kaepernick's protest.
You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. Well, you shouldn't be playing. You shouldn't be there. Maybe you shouldn't be in the country.
Well, now people are seeing Kaepernick's protest in a new light. Let's bring in Mike Pesca. Here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Well, and tell us, first of all, just how the protests over George Floyd's killing are playing out in the world of sports.
Well, a number of NBA players have themselves actually joined the protest. Jaylen Brown driving 12 hours or so to lead a protest. He's with the Celtics. Several members of the Philadelphia 76ers there on hand in Philadelphia. Matias Thybulle and Ben Simmons, Tobias Harris. And then when you add in the statements that are being made on Twitter by athletes, the NBA leading the way, there's a chorus of calling for change. The NBA, and I hope we get into this a little bit, has a plan to come back. And so many of the players, you know, a week ago, this would be the number one thing on their minds. So many of the players are saying, you know, this isn't even the actual thing that made us famous and gives us a platform isn't actually even the thing that's most important right now. It's talking about police brutality and talking about what's going on in America, what's going on in our cities.
Well, we did hear that from New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees, who is apologizing today for saying players who kneel in protest when the NFL season starts would be disrespecting the flag. He was asked during an interview with Yahoo Finance yesterday how the league should react if more players kneel in protest during the national anthem, as Kaepernick did.
I will never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America or our country. Let me just tell you what I see or what I feel when the national anthem is played and when I look at the flag of the United States. I envision my two grandfathers who fought for this country during World War II, one in the Army and one in the Marine Corps, both risking their lives to protect our country and to try to make our country and this world a better place.
Now, Brees' teammate, Malcolm Jenkins, this morning in an Instagram post said those comments were insensitive and completely missed the mark on the issues we're facing right now as a country. Do you think that the protest movement, Mike, is changing the debate over kneeling in the NFL?
Well, you know, it changed Drew Brees' mind, or maybe at least he says it does. So it wasn't just Jenkins, and I'll get to him. You know, Aaron Rodgers, the great NFL quarterback, said about Brees, it has never been about the anthem or the flag. Not then, not now. Listen with an open heart. LeBron James criticized him. Brees' own receiver, Michael Thomas, called him out. But Jenkins, who has been a stalwart of this movement in the NFL, who's on the Players Council, who has always tried to explain to anyone willing to listen what Colin Kaepernick was doing by calling attention to police brutality. Malcolm Jenkins made two Instagram posts, and one he was crying and said of Brees, it's unfortunate. I considered past tense you a friend. I looked up to you. Sometimes you need to shut. And then he used an expletive and told him to shut up. And then he did another post, and he didn't really pull that back, but he gathered himself a little bit. And then he said he talked to Brees, and Brees issued an apology today, which some people are saying, well, it's good that he realizes that what he said was at least inopportune. But other people are pointing out, well, we just heard what you played there. You know, here's what I think, and I'll never change my opinion of it. So was he wrong then? Is he wrong now? It does get to the bigger issue of what is the league going to do? Should play resume with this ongoing ongoing issue of players wanting to take a knee? They've never had a good solution to it. And their commissioner, Roger Goodell, is once again in a position of trying to represent owners' interests. Owners are generally pro-business and they don't want controversy, balancing that against the 70% of the players in the league who are black, also white players who chafe under the dictates that they not express truly held beliefs.
Okay, just briefly, Mike, I know you wanted to get to the NBA, so let's do that. The Board of Governors is reportedly close to approving a plan to restart the season with 22 teams. What do we know about that and when it might happen?
Okay, so it might happen maybe from a July start point. They might, if this plan goes into place, might play 8 regular season games. And it's odd, 22 teams. That means 8 teams are looking out. What they've essentially done is lopped off the teams that would have no chance to make the playoffs, because players were saying, I don't want to come back and maybe risk my health and get back into shape with no chance to even make the playoffs. Some owners are a little upset about that because they won't have a chance to make money. But then they run this 8-game regular season, allowing some teams maybe who weren't in a playoff position to earn their place in. Then, if all goes well, we start the playoffs and we have a championship maybe in October. Again, a lot of maybes.
We'll see. I'm sure it would make a lot of people happy. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.